are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents and students worldwide.
So my legacy is to trigger a really positive change in education where teenagers are happy to learn, teachers are happy to teach, not stressed out, and we start seeing more of what humans really are and how we really learn in education.
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources, and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance, and research-based publications.
This week, listen to Ross McGill, founder of Teacher Toolkit, interview Shafina Iqbal, A-level psychology teacher and LEGO education lead, and part-time PhD student at Imperial College. In today's podcast, some of the things we'll be discussing are why Shafina started using LEGO in the classroom, being a researcher and a classroom practitioner, and academic plagiarism and citation in the social media era.
Hello everyone, this is Ross at Teacher Toolkit, the most influential blog on education in the UK. Today I'm joined by psychology teacher Shafina Iqbal, who is a PhD part-time student at Imperial College. Good afternoon, Shafina.
Hi, good afternoon, Ross. Thanks for the lovely introduction. You did miss out something very important.
Yes, LEGO education.
Yes. I am a LEGO education lead at my college, which is just a fancy word to say that I sort of get to, well, not own, but play with and hopefully inspire teachers to work with using LEGO in the curriculum.
Right, so let's go straight to that. You know, LEGO, if I belittle it, we've got a little bit of LEGO in the classroom and on the surface it just looks like we're playing around with it. And I know there's a lot more theory and we don't necessarily want to talk about your research in too much detail in this podcast, but give us a synopsis as to why it's important and the kind of things that you've discovered.
Well, I discovered it purely as a way of engaging some Year 7s I did a very long time ago in a previous school, and it was just... They were a really hyperactive bunch. They wanted to blow up things. They wanted to just do lots and lots of hands-on science. And whilst there are hands-on practicals in the science curriculum at Key Stage 3, and I'm talking a few years ago already now, I found that it wasn't enough for them. So I often had to wait for when I was sort of in the teaching order, when I was due to teach a particular subject that had all this kind of fun engagement to it. And I just thought, how could I really spice up some of the stuff that they already knew from primary, or B, they just found it hard to engage with. And so I just literally took some regular Lego, the retail stuff, from home, bribed my kids, took that into the class and just sort of literally experimented. You know, what happens if I take Lego into a classroom and teach with that? And it was really, really simple. At the time, we were looking at types of cells in the human body. So we're looking at brain cells, plant cells, animal cells, and all the rest of it. And I think the Lego just completely not just hooked them onto the learning, but they were just, it was self-behavior managed. Literally, I had none of that hyperactivity in terms of, you know, not listening, not paying attention. They were just so engaged. They worked so collaboratively. And the best part of it was they actually remembered what they did. And I know there's a big push for retrieval at the moment. And I just sort of just carried that.
How long have you been using Lego in your classroom?
Over 8 years now.
I know kids come and go in school environments, but if we think of a class that maybe used it a couple of years with you, you know, did the behaviour improve in the long term, or was it just an initial bit of excitement?
Well, I'm a sixth form teacher, but in my previous school where I had to, in the early days where I had to teach a Key Stage 3 class, yes, it was wonderful. With sixth form, obviously, I don't have the same behavioural challenges. Yeah. But I can share with you that colleagues of mine where I work at the London Design and Engineering UTC who teach Key Stage 4 in the last couple of years where, you know, I've literally said to them, have a go at using Lego. And the first thing I got from one particular colleague, are you crazy? It's going to be all over the place. And I said, well, A, that's the point, but B, just have a go. And so I sat with her and looked at what she was delivering in her lesson a couple of days later. And we just literally, I took some Lego in and I said, right, 5 minutes, tell me what your lesson's about. What are the learning objectives? What do you want them to achieve? Who are your sort of higher ability and the ones that need a bit more scaffold? And we designed a lesson in 5 minutes using Lego. And then she wrote pages and pages of how successful it was.
I just had an idea, the 5 minute Lego plan.
Yes, that's what I was saying to you.
I want to rewind, so I don't want to offend you, but could we go back maybe 30 years and think of your childhood, your life at school, towards a kind of teenage GCSE, O-level maybe exam year? Describe your education.
So it wasn't 30 years ago, Ross. I'm not that old, but thank you. But I'd say half of that, yeah. Yeah, so I had a mix of high school education. I did parts of a year in London, and then I was in the Middle East, all over the Middle East. So my high school experience in terms of adapting was fantastic. I had to constantly adapt, meet people from all over the planet, change schools every year, which was absolutely awful because Dad's job, you know, was constantly changing. We had textbook problems. We had exam board changes all the time. We had teachers chopping and changing. Mm-hmm. So mine was, I found it really hard because prior to that, when I went to primary school in the UK and a year and a half at secondary, it was all hands-on learning. It was all project-based. It was all, you're the thinker, you're the doer, you're the maker. And the teacher really did nothing much than actually be the guide, the mentor, the person to actually support you through it. So, and they were probably my bestest teachers ever in my memory, because they got the best out of you. And it was about you. You were the center of the focus. You were the center of the classroom. The learners were doing all the learning and all the hard work. That's how I remember it. You know, my teachers would be sitting there relaxed with a cup of coffee while we'd all be doing whatever it was on massive sugar paper.
And what was your journey after school into kind of university?
And then before university, when I had in the Middle East, my experience was very, very different. It was very teacher-driven, very teacher-led, very copy down your notes right from the blackboard, you know, that side of learning. And then when I went to university, came back to England, went to university, I started seeing more sort of, I learned more, much better through the seminars and the tutorials, the really hands-on workshops. This is how you do the stats, you know, let's have a go at it. And that started sort of making me think about how I was learning back in school. And I didn't like it. I almost wish I could have gone back into time and changed how I learned. And then obviously I became a teacher purely by accident and fell in love with it. And I thought, I want to do something different in the classroom. I don't want to be the person that, I don't want my learners to be who I was back then, who struggled. Not because I was unintelligent or anything, just because I didn't learn that way. And I found that it was too much of the same things happening all the time. And I thought, what can I do differently that maybe makes it even better or makes the whole experience just and more enjoyable?
Why did the kind of psychology teacher conversation start to emerge?
I think it happened in my in that first school of mine, as I said, when I was teaching the little ones, because my training and my teaching is all post-16 and university led. I've done teaching at university level as well. And I thought, I found it really difficult to teach the little kids. I'm being honest here. And I thought, I have to get over this. And it was honestly the Lego that I brought into the classroom that changed how I was beginning to teach. And then when I joined the college I'm currently at, literally at interview, it was, well, you're going to have to go to Denmark and train as a certified Lego education teacher trainer. And I thought, what on earth is that? And that's where the real big journey began. So really big
network. Kind of emerging into teacher training in some shape or form. So I'm going to come back to that in a moment. Could you describe to listeners your kind of average week fitting in your research as well?
Oh my God, really?
Let's start with a week before we go into the research conversation.
So my average week, well, I'm a part-time teacher because I'm doing a part-time PhD. I don't think I could, and even that is really, really hard, to be honest with you. Juggling the highs and lows of both. In a typical week at the moment in COVID is very demanding, to be honest. I feel like it's really full on. Not because I haven't planned my work and I haven't done my things. I just think having had the big gap with lockdown, it's just sort of re-establishing those routines, getting expectations back, and just re-managing the same things that you did almost automatically again. I think that's been a bit of a challenge with this particular first term, but it's coming under control now. And so when I've had a very busy first half term, my PhD has, I won't say taken a back seat, because I obviously read and write, but it but I need to be immersed into it. And I haven't had that immersive time because work has just been, you know, busy because it is, you know, I teach sixth formers.
Prior to the virus, were you finding it, I know research full stops a challenge part time, but were you finding an opportunity to do it on a weekly basis or anything like that?
Yes, I think far better because I was just into the rhythm or the swing of it all, I think. Yeah. So I was. And obviously through lockdown, everything just went completely, you know, on a completely different wavelength, to be honest, where it was more, Ross, it was more to the way I managed it is where there were highs in teaching, I was facing lows in my PhD. Where there were lows in my teaching, I was on a high in my PhD. Sure. Just because I find that I work better in long bursts rather than in short bursts, short bits every day.
Now we connected a couple of years ago, and about a year ago you switched universities, is that right?
Yes, I did. I'm
not good at the details. Could you tell us maybe why that was? Because I'm sure all of us in research face different challenges, and partly having to change university or supervisors is a challenge.
I mean, to be honest with you, I think my supervisor was lovely. She's absolutely amazing at UCL. She was brilliant. But I think their focus was more on the spatial and navigational aspects of learning, sort of. And also she left to another university and I wasn't ready to transfer out of London just because I live here. It's my home. It's just easy. I wanted something to just make it easier for myself. And to be honest, I sort of just kept it floating for a while. I thought about Cambridge, very nearly applied there. Then Durham was on the cards. But then I sort of just, Imperial just happened. It was really, really sudden. I hadn't even planned it or thought about it. But I found a department that sort of very much focused with a very multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary way of looking at sort of creativity and me being the teacher. They welcomed my ideas and the kind of work that I was doing. So I'm really happy. There's a fantastic department. You know, such innovative and creative people I'm surrounded with.
So how does your research influence your teaching, and how does your teaching influence your research?
Well, I think first and foremost, being a teacher, you're always trying to improve. Well, I would hope that everybody's trying to improve their classroom practice. But I find myself to be really, really reflective, not when I'm in the classroom, actually, when I'm outside, you know, when I've got that headspace.
Yeah.
And I wanted to sort of understand, I wanted to be the researcher that is actually a practitioner as well, Ross, because whilst there are there are fantastic educators out there, fantastic researchers, I didn't want to be removed from the classroom because I wanted to do something that was sort of demonstrating those things more immediately rather than several months down the line. And so some of the things that I'm doing around Lego influences my research, both in my PhD, but also my classroom-based research, you know, things that are not necessarily aligned with my PhD, but how I set myself mini research targets as a teacher, and how I think, okay, in 6 weeks' time, I need to be using this in this way and this in that way, which not necessarily will feed into my PhD, but I think the two connected is massively advantageous if you're in education or anthropology or sort of the social sciences, as well as the behavioral sciences, just because we've got the data from neuroscience, we've got the data from cognition, you've got all these sort of research coming out on retrieval practice and working memory and long-term memory. We've known this for decades.
As a psychology specialist, what are your views on the profession getting more interested in retrieval and cognitive science? Good thing, belittling your specialism, or both of those, or, you know, what are your thoughts?
Oh, that's a hard one. That's actually a hard one. And I say it's hard because, yes, psychology is my subject, my discipline, my passion. You know, I've been doing it for a really long time. And I feel that I think we need to be careful about things like that, because whilst, yes, the evidence is there. You know, it's something I teach in A-level psychology every year, you know, models of memory, for example, and attention and things like that. And I think that, yes, the evidence is there, but I don't think it's all about retrieval. that's my issue. And I know that that's what the new inspection framework is looking at. How do we sequence the curriculum so that there is that repetition of learning? So it's not just you know, you don't forget, for example. And I understand completely where it's coming from. I understand that it's necessary, but I do think that it's overemphasized, because it's all leading up to an exam. And whilst I think exam has a place, absolutely has a place, I don't think it's everything. And I don't think it should be everything, because it's about the skills that the learners need. Yes, time management is covered in exams, deadlines, speed and accuracy, all of those things are monitored in an exam. But if you look at the psychology curriculum, for example, they have to memorize to some degree. So my work using Lego with research helps them to memorize, but also brings in other skills and other discussion points in the classroom that the specification or the exam will not necessarily explicitly ask you to do, but it will help them in that journey of learning. So I do think that we need to be a little bit weary of becoming too inundated with research that's now 50, 60 years old, which still has so much value. Obviously, working memory model, as we know, you know, is such a fantastic explanation of the current load on learning, not just as a teenager or a child, but even for adults. You know, you switch off after 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. How can we change that, or how can we adapt so that we're actually helping ourselves rather than just making it all about memory?
Learning and adapting. Tell me more about how you've slowly moved into kind of teacher training. Now, for listeners, you travel into different parts of the world, sharing your ideas and research. Tell me, you know, how did that happen? How do you feel about doing it? Tell me some of the kind of things you've been doing.
So, along with Lego Education, obviously, I'm one of their global ambassadors. I share their values. I share their work. I absolutely love what they do, and it's one of the key aspects of our skills-based curriculum where I work. And it was literally through I do a lot, as you know, where you and I met. We met on the EdTech podcast and the Bet Show. I volunteer in a lot of events. I also just like to network and just see what people are getting up to. And through that, through networking and through what Lego Education know that I do, I get invited by different countries. So, for example, the Ministry of Education in Vietnam, in Italy, in Mexico twice now, for different conferences and things on pedagogy and tech, using technology in the curriculum. And all I do when I go out there is share how we are using this fantastic toy in education at my college. That's literally what I do. So I'm sharing what all my staff are doing, all my wonderful colleagues are doing, why it works. And it's really about encouraging teachers to take risk in the classroom. And I know that they're all going to say, we don't have time, we've got curriculums to finish, there's an exam to be prepared for. But I do think that if it's not about adding something new on into the lesson, it's about using that in place of you standing and talking or going through five PowerPoint slides.
Now, you'll know my passion's reducing teacher workload. You mentioned, you know, the virus, you know, extra amounts of work. Using the Lego to replace, not add. What would be, you know, what are your workload insights, and what would be your number one tip?
I think you need to give yourself some breathing space every day, and that's me saying it very reflecting over the last few weeks. I went over the top myself.
What's it like to be a teacher now in COVID? What are the day-to-day challenges for people listening?
I think it's just things are just taking a bit longer to do because you've got to squeeze in these other things in your day. So then you're sort of having a bit less time to do the things you normally would have done pre-COVID. As an example, you've got the one-way system in now. So, for example, if I need to go to my photocopier, which is literally just outside my classroom, I now have to go all the way around. And if I've forgotten something, I've got to go all the way round, and that's not the school's fault. We're following government guidelines, and every school's in the same boat. But I do think that it's cutting into being efficient, effective planners. That's all it is.
You mentioned the tip for everyone is finding time to reflect and unwind at this time.
My tip at the moment is switch off on a Friday night, which I never used to. I switch off on a Friday night. I watched Pearl Harbor the other night and I felt so happy. I thought, I haven't watched a movie in how many months? Right. and I think just switch off, and because it's too much in the week.
Yeah. So I want to talk about one more kind of interesting area. Before we came online, we talked about our own PhD doc research and how, you know, I've been blogging parts of it transparently and you've been kind of guided towards kind of closing in a little bit. I don't want to talk about specifics, but what are your views on, you know, plagiarism and the academic world and sharing and all those?
Oh no, Ross, you've opened a can of worms. I think as academics, i.e. PhD students, and I think as teachers, as practitioners, we should share, and I share everything I do. I'm an open book that way in terms of, and my college is fantastic with sharing things, okay? And I think that's great. In terms of plagiarism, please cite the source. Please tell us where you were inspired from. Mm-hmm. Because it is such hard work that we as researchers are putting in over and above our paid job, that, you know, the day job, which you all know in teaching is really busy anyway. And we're having to find hours in our day to do this PhD for the betterment of society, whether it's education or medicine or whatever it is that you're doing in your doctorate. And I do feel that it's getting to the point where I find lots and lots of people, you know, following me, connecting with me, people I've never heard from in my life before, messaging me random one-off messages. Oh, we love that. Can we please use it? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can. Of course you can use it. But can you just cite where the idea came from? Mm-hmm. And I find that there needs to be, whilst we train our students, for example, at A-level to cite and do referencing and citation and source, and at university there's such a big push on plagiarism and we've got Turnitin software and things like that. On social media, I think we have to be really careful. And I think that a lot of people are out there to take your ideas but not give you any credit for it. And I think we need to change that mindset because it's somebody else's hard work. As an example, I volunteered with the London Brain Project, which was an initiative started by a group of researchers that worked at King's College. And I absolutely loved what they did with young children and the brain and teaching them about the functions of the brain, to the point where I've adapted that same thing for one of my most famous successful psychology lessons, but I use it with Lego. But I always credit them. And I say this was inspired by the London Brain Project. So likewise, I feel that I'm having to sort of be a little bit more discreet about my own work. I don't want to be, but I just think I need to be now because of what I'm seeing happen. And I just think it's not nice. It's not professional. Yeah. It's what's the word?
Food for thought for everyone publishing their own work, copyright. You know, I've been on both sides of the fence myself. Right, we've passed the 20-minute barrier by a few minutes, and I'm going to throw some quick-fire questions at you, Shafina, and hopefully I can kind of catch you off guard. That's the plan. I want some quick responses, please. No pause or hesitation. What advice would you give to your 16-year-old self?
Do what you love.
What book are you reading at the moment?
The Brain That Changes Itself.
Okay, fantastic. What's been your greatest challenge being a Muslim educator?
No, I haven't had any.
Okay, that's great to hear. Top tips for TED Talks. Listeners, Shafina's done a TED Talk.
Stay in the red circle.
What's the title of your TED Talk, just so people can check it out?
The Hand That Rocks the Cradle.
The Hand That Rocks the Cradle.
The Hand That Rocks Creativity. Sorry, that was a movie. Plagiarizing.
What would be your piece of advice for a teacher becoming a researcher?
Go for it. Know how much time you have and make sure the boundaries are clear.
What's your dream job? If you weren't doing this, off the wall, what would be that weird and wonderful job you'd like to do?
To design curriculums that are much more creative and less exam focused.
Okay, so still within education, not like a deep sea diver or anything like that.
I want to kiss a dolphin, but if that counts.
Okay, if I had 48 hours in the Emirates, what would we do?
I would go snorkeling to see the dolphins.
I'll ask that question again. If we had 48 hours in Dubai, what would you show off? Where would you take me?
I'd probably take you to the old Dubai if there's anything left of it, with the old dhows and the creek. Yep.
Oh, the marketplace. Top tip for using Lego in the classroom?
Play with it and figure it out. Let your fingers do the thinking.
Okay. Biggest achievement to date?
so many. Oh God, I'm a teacher. Isn't that a big achievement in itself?
Now you're based in London. What's your favourite place to visit in London?
The museums.
Okay, any particular one?
Both science and natural history. I'm still in awe every time I go. Every time I go, okay. I'm in awe.
Who would you recommend I interview next, and why?
Oh no. I don't know. I haven't got an answer. That's a good, really good. Boris Johnson on education.
Okay, right.
How well does he know our curriculum?
Yeah, well, there we go. It's probably a good point to end the podcast. I'll ask a couple more. What do you have for breakfast?
I had rye toast with avocado and hummus.
Okay, top tip for teachers to look after themselves, what would it be?
Watch a movie, watch TV, sleep as much as you possibly can.
Okay, and for people to consider applying for a PhD, what would you recommend?
I think discuss it with your employer first, especially if you're in education. They need to, so that they can understand, that you may need that time. And if it's specifically related to the classroom, try and work on it with your colleagues as well. Just be transparent in the organisation so you can get the support needed.
Okay, and where can listeners find out about you online?
Twitter and LinkedIn and Instagram.
Okay, have you got a profile name?
Shafina Vora, LinkedIn, Shafina Vora, Instagram, Shafina Vora, Twitter.
Right, we'll add those links. And then my final question, Shafina, what would you hope to be your legacy?
Oh, Ross, you've touched right into me, gone right into my heart there. So my legacy is to trigger a really positive change in education where teenagers are happy to learn, teachers are happy to teach, not stressed out, and we start seeing more of what humans really are and how we really learn in education. That would be, honestly, if I could achieve even a percent of that.
Particularly at the time during the pandemic, yeah. So that's, thank you, Shafina. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And for your interesting insights in the world of academic life, as well as on the front line as a teacher. Yes. Keep up the amazing work. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ross. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.